If not, then you probably are okay. Let's continue on here, dealing with this issue of all the procedures involved, hopefully so that we do things, one, properly, legally, and in an orderly fashion, in order to reflect the highest purpose of law, which is, again, to protect citizens from tyranny and also from the lawlessness of other citizens. This is another reason why we have laws. People tend to focus on the tyranny aspect sometimes, that, or only on that, that the government oversteps its rights, but the fact is we have lawlessness among the populace from which we need to be protected. And that's one of the reasons for the legal systems, so that people who rob, rape, murder, do all these various crimes are taken out of society. So 66 here, as we pointed out, this is designed so we can all, as citizens of the country and as citizens of Grace Bible Church, be protected and enable us to move on in terms of the best affairs and the best welfare of us all. So 66, the legal nation of our land rests first and foremost on the Constitution of the United States as the supreme law of the land. A, the U.S. Constitution is a single document, but it is also the basis for a vast body of law, precedent, and practice that makes up the American legal system. B, a chief purpose of government enshrined in the Bill of Rights and other amendments to the Constitution is the protection of rights and freedoms of individuals. And again, what you have to balance in any organized, civilized society is the desire to protect the rights of individuals and their freedoms with the common good. And this gets to be, in some ways, can be a little dicey because and sometimes they're not always mutually exclusive. Sometimes they are. And sometimes you have to figure out how to benefit the masses. Some laws, obviously, are, in my opinion, foolish. Like, for instance, in Sarasota City, I don't know that it is in the county. Any of you that live in the county can tell me, probably. But they passed this law due to, you know, the elite rich people who didn't like the working man parking his van with his business name in his driveway. And so they passed this law that if you have a work vehicle that has the name of your company or whatever else on it, you got to hide it. And I don't know, I don't know if that's in the county or not, if you have to do that, but in the city, they come and give my neighbor grief regularly because he has his work van with his name on it, and he's got it pulled too far forward in his own driveway, which is pathetic. That is not a purpose for law, in my opinion. That is an overstepping of the, so we can have our citizens, our community be the whatever it is they want it to be. And so the working man there takes it somewhat in the neck. Well, that's inappropriate in my opinion, but if I'm not complaining about what my neighbor's doing, why is the city giving him grief? It's not hurting me. It's not hurting anybody else. So again, you want to protect the rights and freedoms of individuals, see among them freedom of speech and of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of association, right to equal protection under the law, and the right to due process, and a fair trial by one's peers. And again, that's a very important part, is you actually have to have a trial by peers. You can't just, ideally in the legal realm, you don't want just a jury of, you know, a hodgepodge of here and there. You want somebody who actually understands the person, where they're coming from. D, the rule of law in the United States is founded on these principles, which are enshrined in the Constitution, implemented by the laws of Congress, and interpreted by the rulings of judges. 67, without a constitution, such as in Great Britain, people were, at one time, essentially at the mercy of how individuals choose to interpret and administer justice. And so they derived a large body of what we call common law. But they don't have, as it were, a constitution. The closest they could point to would be the Magna Carta, which is not really a constitution. And now they have, you know, more stringent interpretations on all of that, but the fact is, without a constitution, you have no protection. And that's one of the very big arguments for a constitution. A, therefore, criminal defendants have no constitutional rights or guarantees. B, obviously, there is no British Bill of Rights either. C, in Britain, individuals have a right under an unwritten, quote, understanding to do whatever is not prohibited by law. And D, this is completely contrary to the very foundation of American jurisprudence. E, the American founding fathers insisted on a written constitution precisely because they were aware of the dangers and the inherent unfairness of the British system. The last time I checked in my history books, Weren't they abandoning Britain and running to here for freedom, both religious and political? Wasn't that sort of the whole idea of the founding of this country? Was because they recognized the inherent unfairness and all of this of the British system. So they insisted on a written document that spelled these things out, and which it makes obviously very much sense. F, one of the main reasons both the American and Irish revolutions were fought was the desire to escape from the serious injustice intrinsic to British jurisprudence. That system has been guilty of a lot of injustice over the years. So, if that's what people want, they don't want a constitution, they don't want laws, they don't want rules, move to Britain. There you go. Or, if you're really feeling antsy, jump into Afghanistan, because it's now safe for democracy. But they don't really have anything established as of yet. So there are ways to get around this, but to my way of thinking, our founding fathers were pretty smart fellows. They were fairly intelligent, and they recognized what the problems were and sought to alleviate or eliminate those problems by their system of a written constitution, a written bill of rights that guaranteed people their rights. So 68, given the inherent dangers of not having a constitution, any organization without one will likely find itself at the mercy of an unfair system. 69, in the local church, we have the added benefit of an understanding of Bible doctrine, which is reflected in the doctrinal statement, the Constitution, and whatever policies are established. Again, that's why these things take time. If you were to look at, say, the work the board does, in its first initial draft of something, you would see that it undergoes a lot of metamorphosis, that it undergoes a lot of changes before it gets to its final form, because as we work through these things, each deacon, the pastor, may have an individual thought that contributes to it, and that the final product is really a reflection of putting all our heads together and seeking to do the best things in terms of what our understanding of doctrine is and what is in the best interest of the local church, corporately, obviously with procedures and policies, that best, of course, help also represents the rights of the individual as much as you can. So we have all of that. Well, 70, however, various procedures have to be worked out to address specific issues that will confront the local church. And in this case, we're talking about the issue specifically of disciplining an elder. Now, we don't have, at this point, a policy in place for that. At some point, we may have to work one out. Given the guidelines of what we know of what's legal, what's right, what's moral, what's doctrinal, all these things would have to be factored in. Because Paul is, again, as you read these verses, clearly in verse 19, there is no procedure spelled out. Other than in verse 20, when you have a recalcitrant elder who will not acknowledge his wrong, then you got a procedure spelled out there. You rebuke him in the presence of all. It doesn't say you revoke his soul right out of the chute. I would assume that the rebuke is probably the minimum discipline for a recalcitrant elder. In my thinking, this could go far beyond that to actual removal if he continued in the process of whatever he was doing. And again, given the backdrop of 1 Timothy, the eisegogics would tend to indicate that these were doctrinal divisions, that these were doctrinal deviations, not personal sins, quote, in the life of the elder. But sins obviously would factor into this, and clearly so by the participle there, the one sinning. But their sin might consist of a doctrinal deviation more than, quote, what we might call a personal sin. So, again, various procedures have to be worked out for various things. And guess when we work these procedures out? When the issue confronts us. How else are you going to do it? We can't anticipate everything, and nor should, I don't think, should we try to. But when a situation presents itself, and we think, okay, it's time to sharpen our thinking up here, or tighten up our policy here, or our procedure here, or more carefully spell out what is involved in this, then we do it. But it's generally when we are confronted with it. And I would assume that that's how any organization pretty much operates. You can't anticipate everything. We can't write a policy for everything. There's no point in burdening people down needlessly with a bunch of rules and regulations that don't even apply. As we've tried to tighten things up, and again, to more closely reflect, one, what we have in the Bible, and two, what we have in the Constitution. And both are mutually, they work in tandem. They don't work independent of one another. And so the idea here is that, say, you get into Robert's Rules of Order. Well, if you read the book, and good luck. If you got a lot of time and are really, really bored, I would recommend it highly. Other than that, well, not so much. I might read the abridged version. But one of the things it says in there is that they've written out this massive volume. And I mean, you don't have yours, do you? Did anybody bring it? Nobody has one. Okay. It's what? Say yay thick? No, it's not small. And they tell you up front, well, 80% of this you'll never use. Well, okay. Well, I guess it's good that it's in place, but I feel like, and I think the deacons would agree, there's no point in us making 80 rules that we're only going to use 8 of them. What's the point? Why bother to go to all that extra trouble? Just confront what you have to deal with and then work out the particulars according to your understanding of doctrine. And that's the best you can do at any given point in time. What you perceive to be correct, what you perceive to be doctrinal, and what fits with the best rights of the corporation or the congregation corporately, and then the individual as well. But sometimes those are mutually exclusive. You have to look to one or the other in a more, that one takes maybe greater weight on a given situation than another. So these aren't all easy issues. That's the whole point of this. These aren't easy issues. These are difficult issues. And anyone that makes light of them or says they're all that easy, they haven't really done any serious thinking about this then. Because the longer I thought about this, the more I became aware that there's so much that Paul leaves out here. So we have to work this out within the guidelines set down. So 71, it would seem that since we are not to be respecters of persons, again, the same principles would apply to all, the pastor, teacher, deacons, and members of the congregation. 72, in that regard, there it seems that there are as many as 7 phases that could occur when dealing with someone involved in serious doctrinal error or involved in flagrant sinning. Again, background of this epistle, my feeling is that it's more doctrinal error that he's fighting. And that becomes very clear as you get into chapter 6 and verse 3. If anyone teaches differently and does not consent to healthy words, those of the Lord Jesus Christ and the doctrine which is according to godliness, he is conceited and understands nothing. So it appears to me that the doctrinal deviations are foremost in Paul's mind, that certainly as he's writing this book, it appears to me that because of the way he deals with it back again from time to time, that this issue of the false teachers and the teacher wannabes in Ephesus were always behind the scenes in this. That this formed the backdrop against which he wrote. So, A, the charge phase. This could be investigated by a member of the board if he became aware of some matter. If it is originated by a member of the congregation, he would have to poll for witnesses to the charge in view and then report it to the board. B, the investigation phase. This is necessary to determine if the charge is substantial, if the witnesses are credible. And these are issues you have to confront. If we know that a witness, for instance, had a hidden agenda or a preconceived agenda or an underlying amount of hostility, that renders at some level his credibility, at least brings it into question. If a person is just intellectually honest, they're calm, they're rational, they're composed, they're logical, those are the kind of witnesses that you would want. But if a person, again, was known to have all this, it affects their credibility. Again, taking it into the legal realm, if you got a snitch that made a deal with the DA so he could get a reduced charge on another crime, does that not affect his credibility as a witness in the crime in view? Of course it does. Everybody knows that. So, again, you have to determine if the charge is substantial. One, is this something we would even act upon? That has to be the first question. If the witnesses are credible, and if they are willing to confront the accused face-to-face. Some people say, well, I got all these problems, but they're never willing to come face-to-face and deal with it. They do it behind your back. And that's completely, according to doctrine, everything I've seen, completely inappropriate. There is no justification for that. Whatever excuses and rationales people may offer, it's pretty plain that this would have to be done under a legal setting. This would have to be done face-to-face. You would have to come and testify. See, the trial phase, this would involve a courtroom situation in which the charges are either proven or disproven. The accused would have the right to defend himself in the trial phase, as you would in any, as anybody would, I think, and all parties could present their evidence. D, the verdict. Now, this gets into another question I've sort of brushed on here but haven't fully addressed, and that is, who's going to be the judge in all this? In this case, it certainly would appear that Timothy was. As far as I can tell from reading this, that Timothy was not to entertain an accusation too quickly, but that he was to hear it out, and it appears that Timothy was to offer the rebuke. So we don't have a man here, with, as far as I know, with apostolic authority. And so it is, yeah, the verb there, alenko, is a second person singular. So Timothy is to hear the charge. Timothy is to consider the charge. Timothy is to issue the rebuke. Now, how are we going to play that out or work out these procedures, given that we don't have somebody with apostolic authority today? You're going to call a pastor in from another canon to hear the case? And what jurisdiction and rights would he have? Unless all parties would agree that he was the best person to hear the case. How would you do this? Are you going to do this in-house? Would the deacon, if it was an elder, say, would the deacons hear the case? Or if it was a deacon, would the pastor and the other deacon, or other two, or how many ever you had, the other deacons be the judges in the matter? How would that all work out? You certainly can't do this as a democracy. Well, we're going to poll everybody and see what you think. That's just majority rule, and that, as we know, that is largely not effective in dispensing justice. Justice is not a matter of majority rule. In most good legal systems, it's not anyway. So again, all the parties could present their evidence, the verdict. If the verdict is not guilty, then those that brought the charges are instructed to abandon any future activity in regard to that believer in question. And by saying that believer, in regard to that specific charge, that's to be dropped, it's over and done with. If we hear one more word about it, you're going to be in trouble. If you bring a charge and it's not substantiated or it's not dealt with. Or let's say, of course, I can't imagine that any right pastor in his right mind or any deacon in his right mind would want it to get to this state. I would assume he would have made his mind up either, well, okay, this is substantial and I've repented of it. I've changed my mind and I've backed off. You wouldn't want it to get to this state, I wouldn't think, but the recalcitrant elder or deacon probably wouldn't care. He's committed to it, apparently, from all we can see in this, if they're going to keep on sinning. So, again, if the verdict is not guilty, then those that brought the charges are instructed to abandon any future activity in regard to the believer in question about that matter. I should have included in there, you might want to add into your notes, about that specific matter. It doesn't mean that in the future, if this person engages in all kinds of horrific activity, that he's off the hook for good. This doesn't give him a free ride permanently. But in regard to the matter at hand, that they need to drop it. Now, that's not going to be popular with them, as you might imagine, because they've pursued this. And now if it doesn't go their way, then what are they going to do? They've got to expect to understand under grace, okay, we've tried this, we've heard it. We've exonerated him at that level. Fine, we're moving on. Forget it and drop it. If the verdict was guilty, the accused would be advised to cease and desist the activity or doctrinal error in question. Again, say he's teaching salvation of angels or some other weird thing. Some other heterodox doctrine that does not square with the scriptures. The result phase, if the accused acknowledges his guilt and stops engaging in the conduct with which he was charged, he should be restored immediately. And this is the doctrinal goal of all of this. And the person should not lose sight of that this is the doctrinal goal, is healing and restoration and moving on under the principles of grace and forgiveness. It's not to get your pound of flesh. Some people, that's all they want. They want their pound of flesh. And they're not going to be happy till they get it. Well, that's not doctrinal or grace-oriented or anything. That is an agenda that the scriptures don't support, in my opinion. So if he stops it, well, that's good. Now, we got what to do, of course, if he doesn't, in the verse that follows here in verse 20. So there's no indication, for instance, when the incestuous Corinthian recovered, that Paul extended, put him under a long period of probation or anything else. Or for those of you that watched Animal House, double secret probation. You're not only under probation, you're under double secret probation, whatever that means. There's no indication that he wasn't restored immediately. And let's hope that, you know, the pastor would not be involved, or the deacon by application here, in incest. But don't you think that would shock the living daylights out of people? And Paul turns around and says, forgive this guy, restore him, and move on and comfort him. Because he's changed his mind, he's repented of this nonsense, and it's time to move on. It's time for him to move on with his life, and it's time for you to move on with yours. And the scriptures are very plain on that. There's no indication that Paul held this guy out of the church indefinitely, that he didn't just restore him immediately. And that sin would shock most local churches today. You know, you run off with your dad's wife, as it were. So F, the public rebuke. Now, if a person refuses to correct his errant behavior and is removed from the membership of the local church, other believers, and I would assume, again, this is the worst case scenario. You've got all these scenarios in here from the very best. He repents. He confesses. He's forgiven. He's restored. That's the best case scenario in all of this. To the worst case scenario, that you have to remove him. And that's the worst case scenario. See, some people want to jump immediately to the worst case scenario. No, there's lots of things in between. What if he's tried, he confesses, changes his mind, and you never have to get to the public rebuke stage even. Okay? Now there's another scenario in there. What if he doesn't repent and you have to go to the public rebuke stage? The three R's, repent, rebuke, and remove. This is alliteration that the greatest fundy would love. This would be my sermon. So the idea here is, what if he went to the public rebuke stage and then he repented? Then do you go on to here? No, you move back over to here. And any scenarios in between all this could possibly happen, depending upon how recalcitrant the person was, how serious they were about really fulfilling God's plan for their life. And some people are more serious about that than others. That's the nature of positive volition. Some people are positive to a point. They're willing to do this and this and this, but if it goes beyond that, no, they're not going to apply. They just won't. So again, you have all these things not mentioned in here, but all these potential outcomes. And how would you handle each of these outcomes? Well, to me, it's not an issue. To me, it's pretty straightforward. This would be the worst case scenario. This would be the best. And of course, the best would be that it never had to come to a public trial. But if it did, and sometimes it might have to come to a public trial to expose the those making the charges as being spurious. Sometimes it may have to come to a public trial to point out, as Paul says, it is necessary that there are factions among you in order that those who are approved may be manifested. And so you see that sometimes things may come to a head in order to remove the evil from among you or the factious person. And we've got commands about that, too. You tell a person they're factious after a second and a third warning, you blow them off. You're factious. That's it. You've got a factious attitude. People might ask, well, how do you define a factious attitude? Well, it's like great art. I don't know it, but I don't know how to define it, but I know it when I see it. And so F here, again, if a person refuses to correct his behavior, is removed from the membership of the local church, well, clearly he would lose his office. He would no longer be allowed to teach under that scenario. Other believers should be instructed to separate from said believer in order to facilitate spiritual recovery. Again, that's the purpose of separation, is to let believers know you're not acceptable at this level, what you're doing. And we're withdrawing fellowship from you. To show you you're not acceptable. And then G, the recovery phase, this is in order when a believer comes to his spiritual senses, seeks forgiveness, and returns to the local church. What if he went to the worst case scenario? Everybody separated from the guy in question. He realized subsequently God worked in his life, pounded on him, gave him the little, you know, rap upside the head or whatever he did. And God has all sorts of ways, of course, he can deal with believers outside of what we do. But we would have fulfilled the what you bind on earth, I bind in heaven, and what you loose on earth, I loose in heaven. We fulfilled this to the maximum here, and we've removed the person, and we've separated from him. And then what happens if after the worst case scenario, he recovers? Well, you go right back over here. that however long it takes, you've got to be committed to this process, for one thing. And certainly here, what Paul spells out looks like to me to be a process. It's not just, you know, things that happen in 1 minute or 1 hour or 1 day even, that this requires some time to determine. I would assume those sinning, you got to do some investigation to see if they continue to persevere in this activity. And if they don't, well then, okay, you've accomplished your objective. You've dealt with the sin among you or the false doctrine or whatever it is. So what happens if the person goes out here, gets kicked around, comes to their senses and says, I want to come back? You have to receive them back under grace, as far as I understand the principle. And people can do some pretty horrific things. We've got examples and stories of horrific things people can do. And they've recovered. And so some believers don't like to talk about guys like Abraham, who put his wife in a harem, not once, but twice. Any of you ladies down with that? You know what it meant to be in a harem, right? You were a sex toy. At the mercy and the whim of the king. They don't like to discuss Samson, the whore chaser. Wow. And yet Samson's mentioned in Hebrews 11 as one of the great believers. They don't like to talk about King David's adultery. But David was never, he was a man after God's own heart, and I never know that that was ever rescinded of him. They don't like to talk about Solomon and his 700 wives and 300 concubines. How much sex do you need, for goodness sake? I mean, and he wasn't a young guy necessarily at that point. I mean, I understand if you're 18 or 20, but by then he was getting fairly old. So, you know, certain things they don't like to discuss, the incestuous Corinthian, the horrible deals that people do. If they acknowledge it's wrong, repent of it and say, you know, I made a mistake there, I've changed it, I've moved on, what are you going to do other than forgive them? Demand your pound of flesh? I don't see that as being doctrinal here. Well, 73, all believers should understand that the goal of any discipline is to restore the believer, not simply to engage in vendettas, carry grudges, or seek vindication. 2 Corinthians 2, 6-8, which deals with the incestuous Corinthian here in context. This is the very situation to which Paul is referring. And in fact, he's referring to the resolution of that situation more than to the situation itself. Second Corinthians 2, 6, sufficient for such a one is this punishment which was inflicted by the majority. So the local church has to follow the lead of the leadership in this. If the pastor is put out or a deacon is put out or some member is written off, you got to follow the lead of the leadership. I'm sorry. You may not like it. You may not agree with it. But if you were in the position of leadership, we'd have to follow you. It's just that simple. And that it boils down to, and there has to be some unanimity on this in order to really make it work, the punishment inflicted by the majority. So that on the contrary, you should rather forgive and comfort him, lest somehow such a one be overwhelmed by excessive sorrow. And again, people have pulled some real stunts, done some crazy stuff. And my read on this congregation, and I believe I'm right here, my assessment is that people here have been very grace-oriented and put up with a lot of stuff. And that is a commendation in that regard. That they haven't put up with excessive crazy nonsense. They draw the line at a point, but that they have been grace-oriented, and when a person has sinned and acknowledged it, they have treated that person in grace. And that's the right thing to do. But if they're recalcitrant and they don't acknowledge it, that's a whole different ballgame, as we know. So my feeling is here, this is applied at a pretty high level that I'm pretty comfortable with. That believers have done things for other believers, helped them in very serious situations, made applications toward them that are very commendable. And forgive and forget and move on. And that's my take on it. And for that, you're to be commended. So what happens in the alternative? This guy repents, wants to come back, gets his act together. People still shun him, using the Amish term. They still shun him. Even though he's manifested, he's back in class, he's really trying, he wants to do the right thing, and all of that. And then they reject him. Well, guess what? You'd get depressed if people treated you at that level, I think. I would. Well, I'm really trying to do right, and they're still kicking me. But if you're not trying to do right, it's one thing. But if you are, again, this is the whole excessive sorrow thing. The goal is repentance and readmission, not just to grind the guy down. The goal is for him to get his act together. But that he has to acknowledge that that's the problem. So point 8 here, verse 8, wherefore I urge you to reaffirm your love for him. So 74, in that regard, we should all recognize that the Constitution and the principles of due process are to be observed so all can have equal protection. And 75, the Constitution of Grace Bible Church is designed to provide protection for all the parties involved in the local church. And that includes the pastors, the deacons, and the membership. And see, this is people on the outside don't have this protection. We do not offer this to just everybody. That you have to actually be under the umbrella of Grace Bible Church, under that structure, as it were. Okay, well, our time's up, and we want to stop here. And for those who are not members, if you will please vacate. We will be having a brief meeting of the members that will adjourn at 12 o'clock.